Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dana Frank, professor of history at the University of California, who examines why the Obama administration has decided to reverse its position on demanding the reinstatement of the president of Honduras, overthrown in a June 28th coup. Eric LeCompte, chief organizer with School of the Americas Watch, who discusses the 20-year campaign to shut down the U.S. Army's notorious training school for Latin American soldiers at Fort Benning, Georgia. And University of Wisconsin professor of history, Alfred McCoy, who warns against the emergence of a U.S. digital surveillance state. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Guardian newspaper reports that estimates of crude oil supplies are lower than projections given by the International Energy Agency published in the annual World Oil Outlook Report. The IEA report is used by Britain and other nations to guide energy and climate change policy. An IEA whistleblower told The Guardian that the agency's oil estimates are overly optimistic due to pressure from the United States. In 2008, the IEA raised projections of oil production from the current 83 million barrels of oil a day to 105 million barrels in 2030. Peak oil critics say that level of production is not sustainable and warn that the peak of the global oil supply may have already been reached. The whistleblower noted, many inside the organization believe maintaining oil supplies even at 90 million to 95 million barrels of oil a day would be impossible, but there are fears that panic could spread to the financial markets if these figures were brought down further. More optimistic energy analysts say oil demand in advanced economies is near a peak and likely to stabilize due to the new push for clean energy and energy efficiency. Still, global demand for oil is expected to rise for several decades. Morocco has deported prominent human rights activist Aminatou Haddar, a native of the occupied Western Sahara, only weeks after winning the Civil Courage Award from the Train Foundation in Washington, D.C. Haddar, who also won the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Award, was deported to the Canary Islands after writing Western Sahara on her entry form returning to Morocco. In the Canary Islands, Haddar went on a hunger strike and was not allowed to leave, according to a Spanish human rights group. Morocco has occupied the Western Sahara since 1975, when Spain abandoned its former colony. The Polisario Front, which is seeking independence for the Western Sahara, called off its armed campaign against Morocco in 1991 under a plan for a United Nations referendum, which has never taken place. UN talks on the future status of the Western Sahara are ongoing. Since Morocco's invasion in 1975, over 160,000 people have lived in UN refugee camps. In October, Haddar told the website AllAfrica.com that Morocco has inflicted human rights abuses akin to genocide on the Western Sahara, pointing to mass graves and hundreds of Sahrawi people being raped and killed. Pfizer, the world's largest pharmaceutical company, admitted for the second time in 5 years to selling drugs to consumers for uses that have not been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. In early September, Pfizer pled guilty to directing 100 salespeople in the company's Farmacia and Upjohn division to promote the drug Bextra, approved only for arthritis and menstrual discomfort, to be used to relieve acute pain. In pleading guilty to the felony, Pfizer agreed to pay a $1.2 billion fine, the largest criminal fine in U.S. history. The drug giant also agreed to pay civil fines worth another $1 billion. Boston acting U.S. Attorney Michael Lukes, who prosecuted Pfizer in a 2004 case involving unauthorized use of the epilepsy drug Neurontin, told Bloomberg News that Pfizer had repeatedly marketed drugs for things they knew they could not demonstrate efficacy for. That's clearly criminal. Currently, 15% of all prescription drug sales are for unapproved uses. Moreover, doctors write 10 million prescriptions a year for purposes not approved by the FDA. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After a U.S. State Department brokered agreement unraveled, Honduran President Manuel Zelaya, overthrown in a June 28th coup, has rejected the legitimacy of the scheduled November 29th presidential election and urged his supporters to boycott the vote. The October 30th deal would have had the Honduran Congress vote on reinstating Zelaya to office, paving the way for the resignation of the coup-installed President Roberto Micheletti and the formation of a unity government which would then oversee the November 29th ballot. The accord fell apart after the Honduran Congress announced it would delay a vote on Mr. Zelaya's return to power until it received a judgment from the nation's Supreme Court. In response, Zelaya, who has taken refuge in the Brazilian embassy in the Honduran capital, refused to participate in forming the coalition government. The Obama administration further complicated matters when it declared Washington would recognize the winner of the presidential election, despite the coup government's refusal to step down. Washington's position is in direct conflict with most governments across Latin America and the European Union, who have stated they will not recognize the result of the election until Zelaya is returned to office. In a scathing letter sent to President Obama on November 14th, Zelaya rejected any last-minute revival of a settlement when he stated, "As the elected president of the Honduran people, I reaffirm my position that starting today, no matter what, I will not accept any agreement on returning to the presidency of the republic to cover up this coup d'etat." Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dana Frank, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz, who helped organize a letter to President Obama signed by some 240 academics and experts on Latin America, urging him to denounce human rights violations in Honduras and reject any election overseen by the coup government. She examines why the Obama administration has decided to change its position on Honduras.
It's really, really outrageous that the Obama administration has not denounced the human rights situation, did not immediately demand the restoration of Zelaya the minute the coup happened, and has gone on and on with this endless signals to the Micheletti coup government that somehow they could continue in power. And people should also know that just a couple days ago, the AFL-CIO just sent a letter from President Trump of the AFL-CIO to Hillary Clinton asking that the Obama administration not recognize the election and that they restore Zelaya immediately. So that's also happened in the last few days.
What do you think the motivation here of the Obama administration to break away from the rest of the hemisphere? I believe most nations in South America and the Caribbean, Central America, are united in denouncing the coup and not to recognize any election that takes place under the authority of the coup-installed government. Why is the Obama administration moving away from that position?
Well, this is a really big question, and it's not just the Organization of American States, but also the European Union, the United Nations. I mean, it's basically everybody except the United States and now maybe Panama have said you can't recognize this election. So, I mean, I think this is Obama is showing his hand about Latin American policy. And, you know, in the last 15 years, while Bush and predecessors were really concentrating on the Middle East, we've had all these really impressive democratic governments come to power all over Latin America and an end to the history of repressive military dictatorships. And many of these governments are no longer interested in being enthralled to the United States, and they want to have progressive development policies. They want to trade with each other. And they've made incredible strides all over Latin America. And, you know, I think the United States' big corporate interests are deeply threatened by that. And what's happened with Honduras is that the right is really striking back, both the Latin American right and the U.S. right, against these democratic governments all over Latin America. And Zelaya in Honduras was just one of them, and sort of the weakest and, you know, the least left, ironically, and the weakest. And this is a giant proxy war against Hugo Chavez, against Evo Morales in Bolivia, against the governments of El Salvador and Nicaragua. And, you know, I think that the Obama administration, unfortunately, is carrying over many of the same advisors on Latin America, like Thomas Shannon and Restrepo. The same people from the Bush administration are running the State Department foreign policy on Latin America, and it's really about shoring up U.S. elite corporate interests and shoring up the Latin American right. And, you know, you can really see, even since the coup, the new announcement about new bases in Colombia, and more recently about new bases in Panama, and clearly the United States is worried about the stability of its Air Force base, so it used to be called Pomerolo Air Force Base in Honduras. And so now suddenly they're talking about bases in Panama and putting the screws on Panama to support the Honduran election. So I think it's really sad, and I think we put Congress and all of us need to put massive pressure on the Obama administration to not go down this road. I mean, so many people really thought we were going to have a new era of U.S.-Latin American relations. Instead, it's the worst kind of hostility to democracy in Latin America that we're seeing, a replication of back to the Reagan years and this kind of support for military dictatorships, which is really, really tragic.
Obama, as a new president, reached out to many of the progressive governments across Latin America, but could this be the undoing of better relations to come here if Obama digs himself into a position of defending the coup government and the elections that are carried out under their auspices here?
Well, you know, I think in Trinidad in the spring he was really trying to position himself differently, but I think the cat's out of the bag now. I mean, I think that if you watch these Latin American heads of state, they've been so careful not to denounce Obama. If you watch how restrained they've been compared to, you know, Hugo Chavez is like the least restrained person on the planet, and he's been extremely restrained. And I think they don't want to go to the war in the United States, but they also don't want this coup to go forward because they know that they're next. I mean, this is just a test case because we're already halfway to a coup in Paraguay as we speak. There's obviously been there was a coup against Hugo Chavez. We have, you know, there was a potential for a while there for civil war in Bolivia from the right. They know that this is pulled off, that they'll be next. And I think they don't want it to be like Reagan. You know, they don't want it to be like, you know, 50 years of U.S. domination. They don't want it to be like the Cold War. And I think they're trying to hold back, but at the same time, they're absolutely firm that you cannot legitimize an election run by a military coup government. And, you know, this is the classic sort of demonstration election that the United States is famous for in its worst history, and it's its worst history of imperialism, and nobody wants this to be happening, but unfortunately it is, and the United States is alone out there really holding up the legitimacy of this completely repressive government. And I mean, people should know that demonstrations are still being tear gassed. You can't speak in public. The radio stations are constantly being shut down. And, you know, the Venezuelan government is almost comical. They have announced 5 times that they're restoring civil liberties. Well, you can't restore them 5 times if you haven't shut them down 5 times, and they're still not there. People are very afraid. And again, as I said, the military, which is running the coup and beating people up and raiding people in their houses and shutting down the media outlets, is the same people that are controlling the election.
That was Dana Frank, professor of history at the University of California. For more information on the situation in Honduras, visit the website hondurasresists.blogspot.com. 20 years ago, on November 16, 1989, 6 Jesuit priests, their co-worker, and her teenage daughter were assassinated in El Salvador because they were outspoken proponents of a peaceful and just resolution of Salvador's civil war that took 75,000 lives and more than a decade of fighting. A U.S. congressional task force and human rights groups reported that the soldiers responsible in this and many other atrocities across the hemisphere were trained at the U.S. Army School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia. A year later, Father Roy Bourgeois founded School of the Americas Watch, which called for the closure of the military facility that is supported by Americans' tax dollars. In the years since, thousands of people have come to Fort Benning every year on the third weekend in November to commemorate the tens of thousands who have died at the hands of U.S.-trained soldiers, while continuing to demand that Congress close the school. The group helped pass a bill in the House to defund the school in 1999, but the legislation died in the Senate. Then School of the Americas changed its name to the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, or WINSEC, and instituted some changes that made members of Congress less willing to shut it down. SOA Watch maintains that the changes at the military training school are cosmetic. Their supporters chant, "New name, same shame." Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Eric LeCompte, chief organizer with SOA Watch, who's been on staff for a decade. He describes the evolution of politics in Latin America and in the strategies of SOA Watch over the past 20 years, which now include asking President Obama to issue an executive order to close the school, something that would have been unthinkable under President George W. Bush.
Looking at the time period of the 80s through 90s, we were looking at number of brutal dictatorships taking place all through Latin America. And in every country, the great similarity was that what was taking place on behalf of the elite, on behalf of a few, to maintain an economic status quo. And the military was being used to oppress those who would be working for human rights, who would be working to organize unions, those who were struggling for a living wage, for clean water. And when these folks stepped in to try and challenge the status quo, it was the military and all of these regimes that would try and maintain that economic status quo. After that terrible assassination, we found that our tax dollars were directly supporting so many of these militaries financially with military aid, and even with training in the United States, training these soldiers to do the terrible things they were doing in Latin America. A year after the assassination of 14-year-old Selena Ramos, her mother Elba, and the six Catholic Jesuit priests, a U.S. Congressional task force went down to Latin America and found that those responsible for the assassinations of the Jesuits were trained on U.S. soil at the School of the Americas. So a year later, a small group of people gathered in Columbus, Georgia, and vigiled, calling for a closure of the school. As they began to do research, they found that we had actually trained at the School of the Americas 11 dictators throughout Latin America, that we could track almost all the brutal massacres, the assassinations, the genocide of 250,000 people in Guatemala, of 60,000 people in El Salvador. It could be traced directly back to the training we were doing at this school in the U.S. at Fort Benning, Georgia, with our tax dollars. As we focused further on the training, in 1996, we were able to force the Pentagon to release training manuals they had used at the school. And these training manuals clearly illustrated that the school was there to maintain an economic status quo. You see, these manuals, which appeared on the cover of the Washington Post and the New York Times after the Pentagon's release in 1996, clearly advocated the use of such techniques such as torture, assassination, blackmail, kidnap, to be used on union organizers, church leaders, and human rights advocates. That these tactics should be used on those, open quotes, who do union organizing or recruiting. Very clearly, these manuals were advocating these terrible techniques to be used on those that would be working for change in their country, to be used on those that here in the United States we would see as the pillars of our democracy.
Eric LeCompte, many of these countries are now democracies, even though their militaries are still very strong. And some of these leaders are survivors of torture and imprisonment under the old dictators. In more recent years, SOA Watch has gone directly to some of these democracies to ask them to stop sending police and military forces for training to the SOA. Tell us about that.
We've continued our work, and we've always had our legislative work in the United States. We currently have a bill in Congress with 88 members of Congress signed on as co-sponsors who are fighting to close the school with us. And what we realized, in addition to our legislative efforts, with this new change taking place in Latin America, it was important to go and be with those who had been on the front lines, to reforge those relationships with our partners in Latin America. So for the past 5 years, we've been a part of delegations in Latin America, where we're visiting with social movement leaders and also some of these new elected presidents in Latin America. And as a result of these meetings, as a result of working with these new democracies, 5 countries have announced they would no longer send security forces to train at the School of the Americas: Venezuela, Uruguay, Argentina, Bolivia, and Costa Rica. In addition, Chile has announced a dramatic troop drawdown of 2/3 of their forces to be trained at the School of the Americas.
I know that SOA Watch has focused a lot on Honduras since the coup there in June, in which an SOA graduate has been implicated. Will that be a focus of the events this weekend?
Yep, we actually have several social movement leaders, Berto Olivier being one, who will be with us this weekend, coming directly from Honduras just for the vigil.
That was Eric LeCompte, chief organizer with School of the Americas Watch. For more information, including a link to the so-called torture manuals, contact the group at area code 202-234-3440 or visit their website at soaw.org. Through covert and overt operations to monitor phone and email communication, massive collection of personal medical and financial data, airline passenger watch lists, and extra-legal measures to detain and interrogate persons suspected of terrorist ties, constitutionally protected civil liberties, and many core values of democracy are now under attack. Alfred McCoy, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, is the author of The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, a groundbreaking work that the CIA attempted to suppress in 1972 for its investigation into U.S. intelligence agencies' complicity in the narcotics trade during the Cold War. More recently, McCoy has written about the government's use of torture in the War on Terror. In his latest book, Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State, McCoy examines how intelligence gathering techniques developed in foreign wars and occupations have been brought back home to be employed against U.S. citizens. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Professor McCoy, who explains how the ongoing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have served as a laboratory for the development of high-tech methods of surveillance that are now being imported for use in domestic intelligence programs, many of which have been embraced by the Obama administration.
Now, all of this very sophisticated technology is starting to come home to the United States. Now, you remember that back in April 2002, when President Bush announced the TIPS program, and that was going to be just like World War One, just like the Philippines. It was going to be civilian surveillance. He called upon letter carriers, deliverymen, train conductors, everybody to report information if you see anything suspicious. And there was a huge hue and cry simultaneously. Admiral Poindexter inside the Pentagon created the Total Information Awareness Program, and he created the Information Awareness Office with this eerie, all-seeing eye pyramid logo, and Congress freaked out and barred that program from operating. Well, it turned out that Bush pushed back in the public arena, didn't give up the idea of mass surveillance. What he did was he went secret and illegal and took it digital deep inside the intelligence community. And beginning in 2002, the National Security Agency began illegal wiretaps inside the United States. We don't know how many there were. This expanded. The FBI in 2004 set up the Investigative Data Warehouse, a deep data mining which, as of this year, is up to 1 billion documents, driver's license, social security records, court records, passport applications, you name it, 1 billion domestic documents growing unchecked inside this vast investigative data warehouse. The FBI also set up the terrorist watch list. It's got 400,000 names on it, and it adds new names at the rate of 1,600 a day.
President Obama campaigned for the presidency, saying that he would reverse a lot of these abuses of civil liberties if he should win the White House. Now that he's there, what has he done in terms of reversing these programs that had this massive data mining and tapping of phone calls and emails and all sorts of communications? What has President Obama done here?
Well, first of all, you got to remember that by the time President Bush left office, Congress had already legalized his illegal actions and expanded the ambit or the authority of NSA to do what Bush wanted. Okay, so Obama doesn't have to be illegal to do this. What President Obama has done is he's expanded it. First of all, he's not pulled back any of the programs. They've continued to grow. And second of all, he's expanded it. He's added a new, extraordinarily powerful layer on top of FBI and NSA. Okay, he's created a new data mining agency, a military cyber command, which is now being established at Lackland Air Base in Texas with 7,000 employees. And this is supposed to defend us from cyber attacks, supposed to engage in offensive cyber warfare. But the Pentagon's top cyber warfare General James Cartwright says that it's inevitable that he's going to intrude into domestic cyberspace.
What's your quick answer to people who really don't put any stock in Benjamin Franklin's adage that those who would trade liberty for security deserve neither? There are many people in this country who believe all this extra security and surveillance has to be done in the name of protecting this nation from future terrorist attacks or whoever the enemy is at the moment. As you said, this is an historical trend that we've been following here in this country. What's your answer to those who think that all this is necessary?
When you take each program, for example, can anybody really argue with the idea of having a Predator B drone, you know, flying back and forth across the North Dakota-Manitoba border, securing our northern frontier? No, seems quite reasonable. Each one of these programs, every piece in this emerging puzzle seems quite reasonable. But when you add it together, which nobody is doing, and if my article and my book have any utility, are making any contribution, that's the contribution. I take all the pieces, I put them together, and say, look, here's the dystopian, the anti-utopian vision of an America that's not in the future, it's almost here. It's almost here. It's a few digital tweaks away from being here. And I submit that if you actually show this vision to somebody, let's say, on the far libertarian right of the Republican Party, and you showed it to somebody on the civil liberties left of the Democratic Party, and Americans at every point in between, I think most of us would agree, we don't like this picture. And it's this picture which is taking place. The technology is building upon itself. And it's time for us to realize where we're heading and to check it in some way. And we can do that. We beat this back in the 1970s. That's why we had the FISA laws. It can be done. We pushed it back in the 70s. We can do it again today.
That was Alfred McCoy, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and author of Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State. Read an article adapted from the book titled Welcome Home War at the website tomdispatch.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.